بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الكريم. اللهم زدنا علما كثيرا وفقها في الدين وعملا متقبلا يا أكرم الأكرمين. اللهم اجعلنا ممن يستمعون القول فيتبعون أحسنه. اللهم علمنا التأويل وفقهنا في الدين، وافتح علينا فتوح العارفين بدارك، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله وهو العلي العظيم. أما بعد، السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. And welcome back inshallah to our 15th class in the series of classes on the explanation of the chapter of Al-Mi'ah in the book Bulugh al-Maram and Adillat al-Ahkam that was compiled by Shaykh al-Hafidh Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. Inshallah, today we have a new hadith, and inshallah let's read it together, and then we'll go over the translation and the meaning and the explanation by the ulama. وعن نافع عن ابن عمر قال نهى رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم عن الشغار، والشغار أن يزوج الرجل ابنته على أن يزوجه الآخر ابنته وليس بينهما صداق. حديث متفق عليه. This hadith is narrated by نافع from Ibn Umar, may Allah be pleased with them both, who narrated that the Prophet ﷺ prohibited the shighar. Shighar is explained in the hadith. A shighar means that a man gives his daughter in marriage to a person on condition that that person gives him his daughter in marriage in return, and there's no mahr between the two. This is what is narrated, this is what is explained in the hadith, and the hadith is agreed upon. The hadith is agreed upon by Bukhari and Muslim. So we'll talk in a moment about shighar, what is marriage shighar, and why was it prohibited, what was the reasoning behind it, and we'll look at what the scholars say about the hadith. But before that, let us look at the sanad of the hadith, or the chain of the narration. And this is a very important and beautiful hadith. It's narrated by Imam Malik, according to his teacher, Imam Nafi', who was from the Tabi'een, who heard it from Ibn Umar. Ibn Umar was from the Sahaba. So there's only three people in the chain of narration. Between Imam Malik, then his teacher, the Tabi, Ibn Umar, his teacher Nafi', who heard it from Ibn Umar. So this chain of narration is called a Silsila al-Dhahabiyya, the golden chain. Because the three people in the chain, they're very, very reliable narrators. And the chain is so short, there's only three people in the chain. And this is one of the highest sanads that we find in the books of hadith. So this hadith is of a high level of authenticity, and it's narrated by this golden chain of narrators. Again, Malik an Nafi' an Ibn Umar. This is a very, very strong chain of narrators. So the Prophet ﷺ, he prohibited the zawaj al-shighar. The shighar, which as was mentioned in the hadith, is when a man, he gives his daughter to another person in marriage, on condition that that person gives him his daughter in marriage. They exchange daughters, essentially. And Islam prohibited that. The Prophet ﷺ, in this hadith, he's prohibiting this type of marriage that was common in the days of Jahiliyyah. When Islam came, it cancelled many of the forms of marriage that were common in the days of Jahiliyyah for reasons that we'll see inshallah ta'ala. So the Prophet ﷺ, he says in this hadith, Naha Rasulullah. Naha Rasulullah, the Prophet forbade. We talked about Nahi in a class on Arabic, which is when the Prophet ﷺ says to forbids an action. And the words of the Prophet ﷺ, he's a mushabri', he's the one who is commanding or legislating as he speaks. And he speaks not from his desire, but from the wahi from Allah Azza wa Jal. So when the Prophet ﷺ forbade a type of marriage, then this type of forbidding, it indicates that it's haram, that it's cancelled out, that it's invalid. And for this reason, we find that all of the ulama, they agree that this type of marriage contract is invalid, it's haram. It is a haram marriage contract. And The only exception to this case, when we find the Prophet ﷺ forbidding something from it being haram, is when we have another narration that would indicate that it's permissible. So when you have two narrations, then this indicates that perhaps it isn't for hurma, but it's something makruh, something disliked. It's not necessary that the Prophet forbade it altogether, but maybe he forbade it in certain cases or in certain situations. So we have this hadith that the Prophet ﷺ, he forbade the nikah shighar. And the hadith itself, it tells us what the nikah shighar is. But the question now, also the ulama ask, is, are these words describing the nikah shighar, are they the words of the Prophet ﷺ, or are they the words of one of the narrators? This again, in the science of hadith, it's very important to know if all of the texts of the hadith are the actual words of Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. Because sometimes the narrators, they insert their own comments or their own understanding into the hadith. And that understanding could be correct or it could be mistaken. It doesn't have the same level, the same authority as the words of the Prophet ﷺ. So the scholars of hadith, they made a great deal of effort to compare different texts from different chains to see if every word in the hadith is the words of the Prophet ﷺ. If not, if the narrator inserted his own words, this is called hadith mudraj. Hadith mudraj, where the narrator's words have become mixed with the words of the Prophet ﷺ. And of course, this makes it weak, that those words that are inserted, they are weak and they're not acceptable as words of the Prophet ﷺ. So we find this is common in hadith, that many of the narrators, they explain. They're trying to give it tafsir as they're narrating the hadith. So we find, for example, the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, that when, before the time of Wahi, he used to go to the Ghar Hira, the cave of Hira, and he used to yuhannath, and then it says, وَهُوَ عِبَادًا in the hadith. So this narration of the hadith, it says that the Prophet ﷺ went to the cave of Hira, and he kana yuhannath, which is a type of meditation. And then the narrator, he inserted his tafsir of those words. He said, وَهُوَ عِبَادًا. So those words, وَهُوَ عِبَادًا, they're not part of the original hadith. And so the scholars of hadith, they're very careful to make sure that any words that are inserted by the other narrators, they have to be pointed out, because they're not part of the original narration. We have a famous example where one of the hadith scholars who was narrating hadith in a sitting, and one of the students walked in, and he said, قَالَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ. And then somebody walked in, and he had his face was filled with light. And he said, مَنْ قَامَ فِي اللَّيْلِ حَسَّنَ وَجْهَهُ فِي النَّهَارِ. And then he continued with the hadith. He said, whoever stays up at night in prayer, praying night prayer, his face will be beautiful in the daytime. That was his own comments about the person who walked into the majlis. But the people who were writing the hadith, they thought those were the words of the Prophet ﷺ, so they inserted it into the hadith. And so the words of the narrator got mixed with the words of Rasulullah ﷺ. And of course, this is something that the scholars of hadith are very, very keen to avoid. We don't want to mix any words with the words of Rasulullah ﷺ. We want to preserve every word of his ﷺ. So here we find that the explanation of shighar in this hadith, as it is explained here, وَالشِّغَارُ أَنْ يُزَوَّجَ الرَّجُلُ إِبْنَتَهُ عَلَىٰ أَنْ يُزَوِّجَهُ الْآخَرُ إِبْنَتَهُ وَلَيْسَ بَيْنَهُمَا صَدَاقٌ. These words here, the ulama, they actually had a difference of opinion. Did the Prophet ﷺ actually say these words? And many of them, they said that he didn't say that. They said that these were the words that were said by Ibn Umar, the Sahabi. And some of them, they said, no, even Ibn Umar, he didn't say it, but they were said by, who was below Ibn Umar? Nafi', he was from the Tabi'een, one of the great Imams from the Tabi'een. And some of them, they even said it wasn't Nafi'. Who's the student of Nafi'? Imam Malik. They say Imam Malik, he's the one who narrated these words. But in all cases, they say that the words are correct. Because if it's the words of a Sahabi, he He's not going to say things about the Prophet ﷺ except from what he learned from him. So he would be only conveying what he learned from Rasulullah ﷺ. And they said if it's from the words of the student of Ibn Umar, the Tabi'een, likewise, the Tabi'een, they have a very high status with Allah Azza wa Jalla. So the Tabi'een, they also only convey what they heard from their teachers, from the Sahaba. And if they're the words of Imam Malik, Imam Malik is the great Imam, right? Imam Dar al-Hijra, the Imam of the Masjid in Medina. And so his words, again, are not based on his own opinion, but he would only speak based on the knowledge that he learned and what he found of the people doing in Medina. He would take that and he used that to explain a lot of the rulings in the school of Imam Malik. So we see the explanation of nikah shighar in the hadith. Now let's go to an important question. All the four madhahib, they say nikah shighar is forbidden. And nikah shighar, again, is a person trading his daughter with another person in marriage. He's saying, I give you my daughter, but with the condition that you give me your daughter. And there's no mahr between them. This is what nikah shighar is. Sometimes they also say it could be one sister. Where a person, he says, I'll marry you or I'll wed you my sister on the condition that you wed me, your sister, without any mahr being between them. So the ulama, they looked into this prohibition and they searched for the wisdom. What is the ta'aleen? What is the wisdom behind this prohibition? And there's actually a number of wisdoms, a number of hikmas and wisdoms behind this. The first is that we find that when in a marriage contract, the scholars say that the marriage has to be firm. The offer and the acceptance has to be firm between the two parties. And there shouldn't be conditional statements attached to it. For example, if somebody says, if my daughter comes back from travel, I wed her to you. And then the person replies, I accept. Does the marriage take place? Scholars, they say it doesn't take place. Because there is that conditional statement attached to the words of the marriage. And the words of the marriage have to be very firm. Even they have to be in the past tense. You say, Zawwajtuka, I gave you my daughter, in the past tense. If you use the present tense, the scholars say that the marriage doesn't take place. If you use a question, do you give me your daughter in marriage? And he says, yes. Does the marriage count? It doesn't count. It has to be in the past tense, and it has to be absolute, without any conditions attached to it. So, putting a condition, saying, I wed you my daughter on the condition that you wed me your daughter, this invalidates the marriage contract. So this is one of the wisdoms, that a marriage should be firm, it shouldn't be based upon a condition, or there cannot be a condition attached to the marriage contract. Another wisdom, and another important reason that the Prophet ﷺ forbade this type of marriage, is that it denies the women their due right to the mahr. A daughter, she has a haq, she has a right to be, to receive mahr. And if a father is going to wed her off in order that he marry another woman, then what happened to her right of mahr? It got taken, she didn't receive her right. And so what happened to the women in the days of Jahiliyyah? They were denied this important right, which is the right to have the sadaq, the mahr. So both daughters in this case, in the shighar, neither of them received their mahr. So it's a dhulam, it's a wrong to both of these daughters. They're missing out on what Allah has commanded that they be given, that they be given their right to mahr. And the third reason the scholars say is that the father is the one who's benefiting from the giving his daughter to somebody and that relationship that he has with her. And the father doesn't have the right to use that as the mahr for another woman. He's giving his daughter to somebody in marriage, and he's using that action of his as if it is a type of mahr that he's giving to another woman. And giving your daughter in marriage is not something that has value. It's not something that can be given as mahr. If the father wants to marry that daughter, he has to give her her right. He has to give her her right and give her the mahr in this case. So the scholars say that it is forbidden because of more than one reason. Not simply because there's a condition attached to the wedding, to the marriage, but also because it denies the daughters their fair right. It denies the daughters their fair right in receiving their mahr. And also there's another important reason. And this is a very interesting intellectual reason. The scholars, when they research, when they look into this prohibition, they find what would happen if a nikah shira took place. Say a man, he married another man's daughter, and that man married his daughter. And if the two got along, then their weddings would be fine. But say that Zayd, he wed his daughter to Amr. And Amr, he wed his daughter to Zayd. And say one of them, say Amr decides to divorce his wife. So he divorces his wife, and so what will happen to that woman? She'll go back to her father's house. Right? She'll go back and stay with her father. But who's in her father's house? The daughter of Amr. If she goes to Zayd's house, then the daughter of her ex-husband will be in the house. So the man's daughter and the daughter of her ex-husband, they'll both be in the same house. Do you see how this, what would happen? Two men, they married each other's daughters. So one of them, he divorces the daughter of the other. So she goes back to the house of her father, but her father is married to her ex-husband's daughter. So the two women are in the same house, and of course they're going to have enmity towards one another. And the woman who was divorced, she will try to take revenge on the daughter of her ex-husband. So it will lead to family problems. It will lead to difficulties within the family, and it will cause disharmony. So this reason, this is another one of the wisdoms behind prohibiting this type of marriage, is so that there wouldn't be this conflict of interest, and that somebody, if he wishes to get married, it should be done independently. The marriage should be done independently. Okay, so this is on the Zawaj Shighar, and is there any questions on that? Inshallah, we can read maybe just one more hadith. Yes, brother, go ahead. I didn't understand the question. You said that the Prophet ﷺ married the daughter of Umar, right?
Yeah.
Right. And Umar, he married the daughter of the Prophet ﷺ? Is that what you're saying? Which daughter did he marry? I don't believe that's correct.
Yeah.
No.
I remember.
Right, right. But if, let's say for example, that two people by chance, one person he married the daughter of another, and then later on by chance, the other person decides to wed his daughter to the Prophet ﷺ. This is permissible. It's permissible for two people to marry, but without agreeing that the exchange of daughters is the mahr. If it just happens by chance, they make one wedding, and she has her fair mahr, and then later on they have another wedding, and the other daughter also receives her fair share of mahr, then this is not forbidden. There's no harm in this. This is allowed. This is permissible, according to most of the ulama. There are some scholars that say that it's still forbidden because of the reason that we mentioned, that if one of the two fathers divorces the daughter, she'll go back to the house, and then there'll be conflict. There'll be conflict between her and the other daughter. So they would prohibit it for that reason. Allahu a'lam. So I don't know which two of the Sahaba you're thinking of. I don't think it was the Prophet ﷺ, but maybe it was Umar and Ali. Not Umar and Ali? Because I know that Umar, he married one of the daughters of Ali. And so scholars, they say this shows the love that they had. You know, many people think that Umar and Ali, they didn't have the love between the Sahaba, but they actually had a very good relationship. And Umar, he married one of the daughters of Ali radiallahu anhu. Okay, so let's maybe just read one more hadith, and then inshallah we'll finish after that. وعن ابن عباس رضي الله عنهما أن جارية بكرا أتت النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم فذكرت أن أباها زوجها وهي كارهة. Ibn Abbas, he narrates that a virgin girl came to the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم, and she mentions that her father wed her against her will. Karihatan. She didn't want to be married, but her father wed her off against her will. So she came to the Prophet ﷺ complaining. She said that my father has wed me off against my will. I didn't want to be married to this other person. So the Prophet ﷺ, فَخَيَّرَهَا النَّبِيُّ ﷺ, he gave her the choice. He said, if you like, you can stay with the man that your father married you to, or you can go, you can be separated, I'll annul the marriage. Rawahu Ahmad. This hadith is narrated by Ahmad and Abu Dawood. Again, I'll read the translation. A virgin girl came to the Prophet ﷺ and mentioned that her father had married her against her will. So Allah's Messenger ﷺ allowed her to have her choice, whether she stays in the marriage or not. And so the scholars, they say, this is a very important hadith. It's related to taking the permission of a girl before wedding her, before marrying her. And remember, we mentioned the hadith that a virgin girl, she has to be asked her permission. If the father or the guardian wants to marry a girl to a man, he has to take her permission. He has to get her consent to the marriage. And if not, then as we see in this hadith, what happens? The woman has the choice whether to accept the marriage or to have it annulled. She has a choice to do that. And so we see here how the woman, she came to the Prophet ﷺ and she's complaining. My father has wed me without my permission, against my will. And she said, and she complained to Rasulullah ﷺ, so he gave her the choice whether to stay with the man or not. And this happened in the time of the Prophet ﷺ in a number of occasions. And we also see the one interesting story where this happened to the slave woman of Aisha. Aisha, she had a woman, a servant. Her name was Barira. And Barira was a slave woman, and her husband was a slave. But Aisha freed Barira. She set her free. So now you had a free woman, and she's married to a slave. And this is also one of the occasions where a woman, she has the choice whether to keep the marriage or to annul it. So Barira, she didn't want to keep the marriage. But her husband was very much in love with her. And he used to follow her in the streets and say, Oh Barira, why don't you keep me as your husband? And she wouldn't even look at him. She turned away from him and she didn't want to stay with him. So one day the Prophet ﷺ, he said to Barira, why don't you look into the issue of your husband? Why don't you keep him with you? And stay married to him. So Barira, she said to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, are you interceding or are you commanding? She wanted to ask, is this a command that I have to keep him as a husband, or are you just interceding on his behalf to do a favor for him? And he said, no, I'm only doing a favor for him. I'm doing shafa. I'm just interceding on his behalf. And so she said, with all adab and all kindness, she said, I don't have any need for him. So she was given the choice, and she chose to be separated from him. So the woman, she has a choice to annul the marriage in a number of situations. If she's married without her permission being taken, she has a choice to have it annulled. And also, if this is one of the cases, if there's a difference that the man is not kafa'a, he's not compatible with the woman. For example, Barira's husband was a slave and she was a free woman, so the Prophet ﷺ gave her the choice to annul the marriage. So the The guardianship, or the majority of scholars, they say that if a woman is married without her permission, she has the choice. However, there's one special case, or one special situation. You have the guardians that we talked about, the father, then the son, then the grandfather, then the brothers, then the half-brothers, and then her the woman's cousin, nephews, and then her cousins. That's the order that the scholars say for the guardianship. The father, then the son, then the brothers, and so on. But if you remember, Imam Malik, he said the son is first. But those guardians, any of them, if they wed the girl without her permission, then the marriage can be nullified by the woman. But there is one special case that the ulama talk about, which is if a father, he weds the girl, the daughter, before she reaches the age of bulugh, the age of puberty. If a father, he weds his daughter before the age of puberty, then what happens in this case? Does she have the choice when she reaches the age of puberty to nullify the marriage or not? They all agree that if it was any of the other guardians, then she has the absolute choice to nullify the marriage. But when it comes to the father specifically, then here they have a difference of opinion. And some of the ulama, they say that the girl, when she reaches the age of puberty and her father had married her, then she doesn't have a choice at that time whether to keep the marriage or not. And they use as a proof for that the hadith about Aisha, may Allah be pleased with her, that she got married to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam at the age of 7, and at the age of 9 they consummated the marriage. And we don't find that Aisha was given the choice by her father to keep the marriage or not. And the reason that this school of ulama say that this is allowed only for the father is they say that the father has the most love and compassion for his children. And it's not only for the daughter, it's also the son. He can marry the son to somebody and to wed him before the age of puberty. And they don't have a choice in that case. And they say that this school of ulama, they say that the father, he only wants the best interest of his children. And because of that special closeness and love that a father has for his children, then he's given the special right. That's an exception to the general rule. And as we mentioned before, that in the past this was a very important, this happened very often, where a man would come and he was a very qualified and good suitor for a daughter, and so the father would wed her even though she was not ready for the marriage yet, but in order to preserve her right, preserve her opportunity, and to help her to get married and find a righteous husband. And he might fear that the man might travel and never come back. So this was to protect the daughter and help her and preserve her interest. But there's another school of ulama, the Shafi'i school, they say no. Even the father, if he weds the daughter, she still has a choice when she reaches the age of puberty whether to accept the contract or not. In all cases, we always keep in mind, we remember that the wali, the guardian, he is given the trust of the daughter because he is to protect her interests. It's not that he imposes his will on the daughter, but it's to protect her interests and for her benefit. And if the guardian doesn't do that, if he says, I'm going to marry this daughter to whoever pays the highest mahar, or I'm going to marry my daughter to whoever will give me the biggest gift. It happens in some societies, right? If somebody's going to give me a gift, then he marries his daughter. Then he's not looking out for the interest of his daughter. And of course, as you know, the guardianship can be passed on to another relative if the father does not fulfill the rights. If the father is a fasiq, if the father, he drinks alcohol, for example, is he allowed to be the guardian? The guardianship, one of the rights or one of the conditions of guardianship is he can't be an open fasiq. If he drinks alcohol or he doesn't pray at all, and it's obvious, then the guardianship will go to another relative. So this is something very interesting about the marriage of Aisha. And again, it was to protect her interest It was not something that was to harm her interest, but for her both best interests. And also we find in this hadith here, this hadith where the woman came to the Prophet and she said, "My father married me off and I disliked it and I didn't want it." So the Prophet gave her the choice. So this is very clear that a woman who's married by her father, she has a choice. So how is it that these other ulama say that the father, he has the authority to marry her without her permission? How do they say that? How do they respond to this hadith, basically? Sorry? Yeah, they have the hadith of Aisha, but they say that that's actually the right answer. They say that this woman was a mature woman. She was already over the age of puberty. So because of that, you can see from the hadith, she said, "I dislike the marriage." Usually a woman, she'll have dislike or she'll state her opinion. She has to be older. So the ulama, they said that this hadith is referring to a woman who's already the age of puberty. But for a woman who's under the age of puberty, like Aisha, then in that case, she doesn't have to be given the choice at the time of the wedding. And so I hope I was able to clarify the role of the father. It's not to take advantage of the daughter, but as a guardian, it was in her best interest. And he has love. This is why the uncles are not allowed to wed the daughter without giving her a choice. Or the grandfather, great-grandfather, or the brothers. This is only for the father. And this is preserving that the special love that the father has for his daughter or his son. This is the reason why they allowed that exception, and that's the reason why Aisha was wedded before she had reached the age of puberty. Wallahu ta'ala alam. Okay, so I hope that clarifies this hadith. And in another narration, it gave more detail. It said that her father had wedded her to raise his status. لِيَرْفَى بِهِ خَصِيصَتَهُ. He wanted to become more famous or more honorable. So he forced his daughter to marry this other man. And so the Prophet he called the father and he said, "Did you do this?" And she said, then the man, the father, he said, "Yeah, I wedded her." So the father, the Prophet told the daughter, "If you want, I can let you divorce the man or separate you, or you can keep the marriage." And she said, "I accept what my father has done, but I wanted all the women to know that men do not have a way over them. Men cannot force them against their will to be married." This is the other supporting narrations of this hadith. Okay, so inshallah that brings us to the end of this hadith inshallah ta'ala, and ask Allah to benefit us from these hadith. We had a couple questions that I received, and then inshallah I'll open the floor for your questions as well. His brother Zaid Faruqi, one of the nice, very nice brothers who's been following the classes online, he sent in a question and he said, "Can you tell me about following a madhab? Do I have to follow a madhab?" This is a question that the brother asked. And the ulama, they say there's two extremes when it comes to the madhab. You have two extremes. You have some people who say that we have no need for the madhab at all. We don't have any need for the four imams. All we need is the Quran and the Sunnah, and that we can ignore all of the fuqaha and all of the knowledge that these scholars made, and we can go directly to the Quran and Sunnah and follow those sources. And they say that following the madahib is something wrong and something that we have to leave behind or leave away. And the ulama, they say, this is a blameworthy extreme. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum, you have some people who say that I'm only going to follow the Hanafi madhab. Well, I shouldn't just point out the Hanafi school, but sometimes you find people, they say, "I don't want to listen to anybody else except the Hanafi scholar. I don't want to listen to the Shaykh, is Shafi, I'm not going to listen to him. The Shaykh is from a different madhab, I don't want to hear what he has to teach or what he has to say." And this type of blameworthy ta'assub, they call it, sticking to one's own opinions, this was also had a negative effect. And even in the Haram al-Sharif, the Kaaba, they actually had four maqams. Each maqam was for each madhab. They had four different places. The Hanafis would have their own salah. The Shafis would have their own salah. Malikis and Hanbalis, they each had their own salah in the Haram al-Sharif. This only a few centuries ago. This is how much the ta'assub, the fanaticism, it took over, where people refused to pray behind an imam who was not from their madhab. And this also was common in Jami' Umawi in Damascus. They have four mihrabs, and each school would have their own salah. So this is another blameworthy extreme. But the ulama, they say that the balance is following a middle path, which is that we have to build and we have to follow the madahib that exist, and learn from those ulama and build on the effort that they made in understanding the Sharia. And this is very important, because if we try to go directly to the Quran and Sunnah, what ends up happening is you find that these ulama, they have more differences than you have between the four madahib. You find one alim, he's giving his own opinions based on the Quran and Sunnah, and another alim differs with him completely, and he's also following the Quran and Sunnah. So what happens is you have new madahib being created, like a fifth madhab, or new madahib that are being created, and each one is calling people to follow his madhab. So it's not possible to merge all of the madahib into one single way. And this will end up resulting in creating a new fifth madhab. So the scholars, they say that we cannot do that, we cannot neglect the effort of the ulama that they have made in deriving the rulings. And at the same time, a person should not be too muta'assib or sticking only to his school. I heard in some places in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, if you move your finger in salah, somebody will break your finger after the salah. Very strict. Or if you say Ameen out loud, you might be in trouble. Somebody might punch you after the salah. It's become so strict. You know, people have taken it to too much of an extreme, where they do not want to hear or listen to any view of any of the other madahib. And this is a blameworthy position as well. So the best path is a middle path. When one wants to learn, they can start learning one of the madahib and take that as a basis where they learn and they study the usul of that madhab and increase in their knowledge. But at the same time, they shouldn't say, I'm not listening to a different imam or different scholar because he's not from my madhab, or I won't pray behind him. This is something that's also warned against. And this is what many of the ulama, they talk about. They mention this. Is it obligatory to adhere to a single madhab all the time? The Sheikh Wahab al-Zuhaydi, he was asked this question, and he responded that we cannot say it's obligatory, because we need an evidence from the Quran and Sunnah to say that something is obligatory. But he said it's very beneficial. That way a person will not just follow his own desires and follow the easiest opinions. So he said it's beneficial to do that, but we cannot say that something is obligatory unless we have evidence from the Quran and Sunnah. And he said it's well known that a person, he follows the madhab of his mufti. So a person, when he asks a scholar, then he's following on his madhab in that case. And one final question, and then I'll let you also ask your questions, is I was asked by a number of people about the recent events in the news, what happened in New York and other things, and what does Islam say about that? And the ulama, of course, they say that, one, that Islam is based on its sources, on the Quran and Sunnah. If one wants to say that something is Islamic, for example, people who do things in the name of Islam, do we automatically say this is what Islam teaches? Of course not. We have to look, when we say things that are Islamic, or if somebody does something, we have to look, is what they're doing in accordance to the Quran and Sunnah? If what they're doing is against the Quran and Sunnah, then we have no right to say that this is Islamic, or this has anything to do with Islam. Rather, it's against Islam. So Islam, when you use the word Islamic, it has to be in accordance to what the ulama teach and what the Quran and the Sunnah teaches. To saying, for example, Islamic people doing Islamic terrorism, it's contradictory in itself. It's because Islam teaches people to abide by their covenants and by their contracts, to fulfill their obligations to other nations and other people in society. So those who violate that, they're violating the tenets of Islam. So they're not, we cannot call them Muslim or call the actions that they do Islamic. And this is incorrect to do that. So when we say that something is Islamic, we have to refer back to the sources of Islam and look at what Islam says. And of course Islam says that as people living in a society who've come here with permission from the authorities, then we have to respect the covenants and the treaties that we have, which is to allow others to live peacefully as we are allowed to live peacefully. And it's not right to break that covenant and to harm other people in violation of that treaty. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu awfu bil uqud. Allah says, O you who believe, fulfill your covenants. And many of the ulama, they say this is the shortest ayah in the Quran, one of the shortest ayahs, but filled with the most meanings. Fulfill your covenants with one another, with your wife, with your children, with your parents, with your relatives, with your neighbors, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, with the scholars. All of these things we have obligations towards and we have duties towards. So Muslims are bound by that, and as Muslims living in the West, we're bound to our treaties and our covenant, which is to live in peace with the others in the society, as they are bound to respect and treat us with peace. And so this is what the ulama, they have said on this issue. This is exactly what I'm communicating to you, is what I've read from the ulama regarding the status of minorities living in the West, that they are under the law and the authority of the authorities here. And this is called musta'man. Somebody who's a musta'man, he takes permission to enter a land, and all of the fuqaha, they agree that it's forbidden for him to harm anybody when he enters that land. If somebody goes to a country and he takes permission from the ruler or the authority or those that he appoints, can I enter your land for some purpose, for some trade? And he gives them permission, then all of the madahib and all of the ulama throughout Islamic history have said it is haram for him to harm anybody in that land. Even if that country itself may be at conflict with another Muslim land. The Muslim who enters as a musta'man to deliver a message or to work or to trade, he has to fulfill that right. And this is what we find in the books of fiqh. And this is what Islam teaches. So Islam is free from the actions of some people. We ask Allah to help us to clarify the image of Islam to our non-Muslim colleagues here and towards the media. May Allah help us to show the good image of Islam and the good character of the Prophet ﷺ. And inshallah, if there's any questions, you're welcome to ask. Can be more general than the topic that we had today. If you have any other questions, you can also ask.
Is it allowed to talk, let's say, lying somebody else's daughter and say that you have lying his daughter at the same time with
him? Oh, okay, that's a good question. If two people, one man, he marries the daughter of another and she marries his daughter, but there's a mahr, it shouldn't be, this is still forbidden. This is still forbidden because it's still it still has some semblance of the nikah shigha. Maybe they're just going to exchange mahars and name only. Right? He says, I'll give you 100, and the other one says, I'll give you 100, so they end up not really exchanging anything. So it still has the danger of being nikah shigha. And so the ulama, they say that it shouldn't be done. Even in that case, each one has to be done. Even some of them said that if somebody, a man married another man's daughter, and a few years later,
the other man, he wants to marry his daughter, some of them said it's still forbidden. Because they said it could still lead to conflict within the family, creating conflict. If one should divorce the daughter of the other, then the two women will be in the same house and they'll have conflict with one another. So some of them, they forbade it, even if there's a time span in between. But the majority of the ulama, they say that it shouldn't be at the same time. It should be, each contract has to be separate with a separate mahar, and then it will be permissible. Inshallah. Very good question, inshallah. Is that the okay?
Is there anything pertaining to new sisters?
Right, the exchanging of sisters is the same ruling as nikah shiha. So two people, they exchange sisters, it's the same ruling as two daughters. Comes under the same prohibition. They're both forbidden. And because, remember, we mentioned the reasons. One is that you cannot make one's marriage a condition to another person's marriage. Right? That's forbidden. And number two, that the mahars should be independent. It shouldn't be that you're giving, as if I'm wedding you, my sister or my daughter, as if that's the mahar for you giving me your daughter. That's also forbidden. And three, that it will prevent a woman from getting her fair mahar. So, you know, even if it's a sister, it still has the same reasons for the prohibition. Any other question? Yes, bro. Come on. Oh, okay. This is not nikah shira. The brother is asking. There's two brothers, and they end up marrying two sisters from another family. So this is perfectly permissible. There's no prohibition of this. There.
But he said if there is divorce, so she would come back, but still she goes.
Right. If two brothers, they marry two sisters. So that if one of them divorces one of the sisters, she's not going to come and live with her brother. She's going to live with her father. So then that sister will not create problems for her other sister. In any case, they're both sisters. They're from the same family. So they're not going to create problems for each other. They'll have support for one another. When you have two daughters, the two daughters are from different families. So putting the two daughters in the same house from different families, that will create the conflict. That's a very good question. Also, sisters, is there any questions as well? Oh, okay. Sister, it's a very good question. If someone backbites about his brother and makes tawbah, if he mentions the third person he was backbiting with, is this causing another backbiting? Okay, the tawbah from ghibah. It's a very good question that actually another sister asked as well. When a person that commits ghibah, then part of the shurut or the conditions of making tawbah is going to the person and asking them for forgiveness. Because this has to do with the rights of another person. Tawbah, generally speaking, it has three shurut. Iqla' an adhamb, to stop doing the sin. Number two, an-nadama, an-nadam, to regret it, to know what they did was wrong. And number three is al-azam, to have the firm intention never to go back to the sin again. These are the three conditions of the tawbah. But what about if it has to do with the right of another person? Then there's a fourth condition, which is they have to restore the right back to the person whose right they took. So if somebody stole money, they have to stop stealing, they have to have the regret, they have to promise never to do it again. Is that enough? They have to give the money back to the person they took it from. Then, only then will the tawbah be complete. So likewise, when somebody makes ghiba about another person, he's taken their right for their honor. So in order to fulfill that right, they have to go to the person and ask them. I said, maybe in the past I said something, will you please forgive me? and they'll find the person will forgive them. But Shaykh Ibn Taymiyyah, he said that if you fear that telling the person that you made liba about them will create more conflict, then he said it's enough that you say good things about the person to make up for the bad that you had said about him. He said you don't have to tell him. If you think you go to a person and I tell you, Brother Ismail, I made riba about you, will you forgive me? It will create more ill feeling. Then it's enough if I just tell everybody, Brother Ismail is a very nice brother. He's the best brother. He's very, and especially the opposite of what you had said about him. So if somebody said, so-and-so is stingy, bakhil, he should go and tell people he's very generous to make up for what he had said. And Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah, he said that will be sufficient as tawbah for that. But if he mentions that a third person was also backbiting about him, that's probably not a good idea. Right? If two people, they are making riba about somebody, and then they go to the person and say, I made riba about you with this other person. So then, you're actually creating problem for that third person. So she doesn't have to mention the other person by name. She wants to make, she can just ask that person forgive them. And what you find is that generally people are very happy to hear that. When you say to them, please forgive me for anything, most people are very generous and they'll forgive you, inshallah. Any other questions? They don't forgive you? Well, Allahu A'lam, what I found anyways is that when people, they respond to goodness with goodness. You know, they see that what you're doing is something that you're trying to do something good to make up and atone for what you've done. So, you can always revert to the other opinion, right? If they don't forgive you, then just say good things about them. And inshallah, Allah will forgive you, inshallah. Is that good? Okay? Any other questions? Bilal, you have a question? Oh, okay. Very good question. The brother is asking about haram li ghayrihi and haram li dhatihi. This is a haram, and the scholars, they divide some things that are forbidden into two categories. Things that are forbidden in and of themselves. That's haram li dhatihi for its essence. And then there are things that are forbidden for what they lead to. This is called haram li ghayrihi. That they lead to something haram. So, for example, zina is haram. Haram li dhatihi. But for khalwa with a woman, it's haram li ghayrihi. Being alone in a room with a woman, it can lead to zina. So this is forbidden, haram li ghayrihi. And what happens with the things that are haram li dhatihi, that are forbidden for their essential nature, they never become permissible, except in extreme circumstances. But when something is forbidden for what it leads to, many times that prohibition can be lifted if there's some benefit, if there's some need for it in society. So for example, being alone with a woman or uncovering the awra, for example, the woman, and if it's in front of a doctor, then there's a need for it, then it becomes permissible. Or in front of a judge so that he can identify her, then it becomes permissible. And the scholars, we talked about this in the fiqh of finance, that for example, the credit card, if you pay the bill on time, they still consider it haram, but it's haram li ghayrihi. Because you have the credit card, and you might miss a payment, and then you end up falling into riba. So the scholars, they say to prevent that, you shouldn't even get into the contract of having a credit card. However, it's forbidden not because of the card itself, but because if you pay it on time, then there's no riba on it. So they say because of certain necessities to have a credit card, you need it to build your credit history, and you can't use a debit card all the time. For example, to rent a car, you can't use a debit card. So because of this general need, You can make something that's haram li ghayrihi, something that's forbidden for an external reason, you can make it permissible. But something that is inherently forbidden, then we cannot make it permissible. Like riba itself, we cannot make it permissible. And for example, putting money in the bank, right? The bank, even if you don't take riba, the bank is going to use your money to make riba. So it would be forbidden, but because we have the necessity in general, we don't have places to keep our wealth, then the ulama, they allow placing the money in the bank to preserve it so it doesn't get lost or doesn't get stolen in that case. So those are the main differences between the two. Inshallah. Any other questions? Cindy, you have a question? Jazakallah khair. Anything else? Any other brothers, sisters? Okay, Jazakallah khair. Sallallahu alayhi wa Muhammad wa alayhi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Alhamdulillah wa alayhi wa Jazakumullah khair. Allahumma taqabbal minna wa faqihna fi deen. Waj'alna mimman yastami'u al-qawl fa'itabi'u ahsana. Alhamdulillah wa alayhi wa sallam. So everybody give salam to five people, inshallah.